Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. I stopped at the drugstore the other day on my way to work. My thumb was really hurting, probably from texting too much, so I wanted to buy some painkillers, but I was having a hard time finding them.
It's like the whole store is all about Valentine's Day. My goodness. Happy Valentine's Day. All right, I get it.
Apparently, the sight of red hearts and cute stuffed animals really puts me in a grumpy mood. But since all of this was right in my face, I decided to check out some of the Valentine's Day cards.
Romance, girlfriend, boyfriend, for a girl, for kids, teacher from kids, from dog. All right. I woof you. Oh boy. From cat. Oh, they're sold out. This one says, hugs and kisses. Get it?
So many choices to express love. But every card I saw had hearts on it. And that got me thinking, how did that become a thing? The heart symbol, love, the actual pump in our chest. When did they become so intertwined? I mean, of course, emotions register in our hearts.
The heart races, for instance, when we see somebody that we love or we feel attracted to.
But isn't it the brain that's in the driver's seat here, making us love and feel? Well, sure, but it appears the heart simply won the race to become the organ we associate with love.
Because it was the first trace of life within a human being.
This is cultural historian Faye Bound Alberti, and she told me that even long before scientists proved that the heart is responsible for moving blood around in the body, people thought that the heart was at the center of our existence.
It was associated with the soul and with God. It was the way that God moved through the body, using the heart as the interaction between the spiritual and the physical realms.
Until the advent of modern medicine, European physicians believed the body was governed by four distinct fluids, or humors. Black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood shaped our health and temperament, and the heart played a starring role.
The humors would move towards a person the heart desired, for instance. So when one fell in love, one was falling in love because there was a spiritual reason why one should be in pursuit of that person. Of course, lust could get in the way, the same as it does now. But there was a very medically entrenched reason why the heart was central to feelings of emotions like love.
In the 17th century, physician William Harvey demonstrated what the heart actually does in the body, describing it more like basic plumbing. And still, we continue to romanticize the heart. And that went on even as scientists learned more and more about the role of the brain.
When we think of the brain, it's a rather abstract organ that we don't feel remotely sentimental about. It's not an attractive organ, which is the way the heart itself has been depicted. Although, of course, if you were to look at a heart, an anatomical heart on a butcher's slab, it's rather different to the beautiful hallmark heart that we see on greetings cards. In a sense, it doesn't matter if people think now that emotions are in the brain. The reality is that the heart icon is so ubiquitous that the heart will always symbolize emotion.
And that heart icon that we use to symbolize love is perhaps loosely based on the shape of our physical hearts. Some say it's shaped like the ancient seed of the silphium plant, which was used as a contraceptive, or like two swans, or like women's buttocks.
And what's interesting about it is it's quite a universal symbol. So throughout the world, it's a very recognizable way of saying not only a heart, but also love.
That's historian Faye Bound Alberti. She's written a book called Matters of the Heart. And now that we know why we give out chocolate hearts on Valentine's Day and not chocolate brains, how about some love notes? This week, I fell in love with a hashtag. hashtag actual living scientist. All of this started with a tweet from Alabama wildlife ecologist David Steen. He said on Twitter that most Americans cannot name a living scientist. And soon, scientists from all over the country and the world started introducing themselves and what they do. They used that hashtag. And really, these were love notes to their jobs, the passion for their work just poured out of these tweets. People also had great pictures, so we reached out to a couple of those who participated and we asked them, can you turn this into something we can hear on our show? Here's what we got back.
Hi, my name is Emily Darling and I'm an actual living scientist. I study coral reefs and how to protect them from climate change and how to successfully manage coral reef fisheries. I love what I do because of the amazing people I work with around the world and the opportunity to make a meaningful difference for our oceans into the future.
Emily's in Toronto. We also heard from Jonathan Slatt. He is a scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society.
I work to protect endangered owls in Russia, tigers in China, and shorebirds in the Arctic. I love what I do, be it putting a nest box in a tree for an owl to nest in or helping close down a road to prevent poacher access. These are concrete actions that result in tangible benefits to wildlife.
Here's Arielle Fournier. She is a scientist in Arkansas, and she studies wetlands, and she loves rails.
Rails are these really, really cool secretive birds that live in marshes all over the world and that most people don't see but are really important parts of their ecosystem. I really love studying birds and their habitats because birds are a common ground that reach across hemispheres and cultures and help bring people together. Plus, they're just really fun to work with.
And finally, we heard from Claire Simeon. She also tweeted using the hashtag #ActualLivingScientist. Claire is a conservation medicine veterinarian. She studies how to improve animal, human, and ocean health.
I love what I do because I love translating all the incredible things that our marine mammal patients teach us and sharing it in an accessible way. Plus, who doesn't love getting to see baby sea lion faces every day at work?
Baby sea lions. That sounds so cute. Thank you all for sharing those with us. Those were all scientists who tweeted using the hashtag #ActualLivingScientist. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Spending months doing research on a boat, chasing tigers in China, waiting for hours to spot elusive birds in a marsh, staring at samples under a microscope, hoping a culture will grow in a petri dish. This is what scientists do, and it often doesn't pay all that much. It's the kind of work you do because you love it, and we're going to stick with that theme for a little bit. The Pulse recently hosted a story slam titled From the Heart, where we heard from people who work in healthcare. They talked about how passion fuels what they do. One of our storytellers, Naveen Vij, is a doctor who became a patient, and that experience changed his mission as a physician and his outlook on life.
The hallway outside the neonatal intensive care unit was dark, somewhat cold, and completely quiet. Probably the perfect setting for the phone call I had just received and another that I was about to make. Standing in my green scrubs with one of those oversized sweatshirts from college, I stood there frozen, scared, shaking, gripping my cell phone, and silently waiting for the words of warmth that only a mother could provide. It will be okay, beta. Everything happens for a reason. I had just been diagnosed with hepatitis C. A phone call just prior from Employee Health Services had informed me that I was now a patient and that a needle stick I'd sustained only a few days before was not the source of my infection. How could this be? Where did the hep C come from? Why is this happening to me? In the days and weeks that would follow, I would meet with the liver specialist at my hospital in Cleveland. I would get blood tests done, checking for how much hep C I had in my blood, what flavor or genotype it was, and really how my overall health was doing. Through conversations with my mom and finding some of my old records, I would learn more about where my hep C had likely originated. When I was born in June 1983, I was a really, really small dude. 2 pounds, 1 ounce to be exact, and only 29 weeks gestation. I would spend the next several weeks and months hooked up to tubes, prodded and poked, and likely receiving multiple blood transfusions that were the source of my infection. For 26 years, it lived silently within me, slowly damaging my liver without causing me any symptoms. In June 2010, I began my 6-month treatment journey for my Hep C and struggled with that question of why this happened to me. Every day, I would take 4 pills of ribavirin, and every week, I would give myself an injection in my belly of interferon. It was rough at times. I lost some weight, felt like I had the flu often, and often felt depressed or down. In December of 2010, I completed my treatment for Hep C and was told that it would be another 6 months before I would know whether it had worked. Nearly a week after I completed my own treatment for Hep C, my mom was encountering her own health journey. Complications from chemotherapy from head and neck cancer had left my mom in a partially vegetative state. She couldn't talk, she couldn't respond. She and my family, as her primary caregivers, would spend January to June of 2011 in the maze of the American healthcare system, hospital after hospital, multiple nursing facilities, fighting the insurance company for coverage, raising money to pay for healthcare costs, and ultimately hospice at home left all of us feeling drained and ultimately thinking back to those words she could no longer tell us, "Everything happens for a reason." She passed away on June 17th, 2011, and about a month later, I found myself back in Cleveland in the office of my nurse practitioner. I had been cured of hepatitis C, I was told. I remember hugging my nurse practitioner, Madeline, and her telling me, "Your mother would be really proud today." She was right. In that very moment, I knew what the weeks and months of that past year had meant. I was lucky to get my needle stick and learn of my diagnosis. I was lucky to have my then girlfriend, now my wife, by my side every step of the way. I was lucky to have friends and family. When I thought back to my mom's words, "Everything happens for a reason," I had found my reason. Most people with hepatitis C don't know they have it. By some estimates, nearly 50 to 75% of patients who are living with it don't know they're infected. My role now, as a physician, as a patient, as a person, was to help others feel lucky in their own journey. Thank you.
This was part of our recent Story Slam we hosted together with the people who publish a journal called The Annals of Internal Medicine. Naveen Vij is a physician, and he spends a lot of his time working on issues around Hep C. It's almost Valentine's Day, and given what we do here at The Pulse, all of those cute red hearts all around us got us thinking about cardiology and advances in that field. In 2012, Sally Poliwada was out for a Sunday bike ride when she came across a guy who was passed out. He was turning blue, wasn't looking good. Sally is an emergency room nurse, and she thought this would not end well. But she was wrong. Her kindness and her deft intervention, along with an amazing sort of low-tech treatment, saved the man's life. His name is Zach Conrad.
Yeah, so back at the time this happened, right, I was 36, healthy, and I had just gotten married 2 months prior.
Reporter Todd Bookman met Zach and the woman he recently married.
My name is Maura Conrad, and I'm the wife of Zach Conrad.
All right, I'll let Todd pick things up from here.
Maura and Zach live in the center of Philadelphia in a small row home on a side street. Zach is tall and wiry, unfailingly polite. And on the day he basically died, it started out as a pretty normal morning. Maura, who's a doctor, had just finished up work.
So I was a pediatric resident at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I'd worked a 24-hour shift and had just come home from that.
And so I picked her up and we'd had breakfast.
They went out to a local spot.
I think Zach had a burrito and I had a Bloody Mary.
They go back home.
Put her to sleep and headed out for a bike ride.
So Zach is out on this bike trail, carving through the woods. He's planning on riding for about 2 hours, which wasn't unreasonable for him. He'd been doing triathlons and was in pretty good shape. Zach doesn't actually remember what happened next. All the blanks have been filled in by various witnesses.
Biking along and must have realized that something wasn't quite right. and stopped, got off my bike, sat down next to a wall and took my helmet off, and then proceeded to slump over.
He's splayed out on the ground. He seems passed out. But it's actually worse than that. And that's how a woman, a passerby named Charity, finds him.
Looked at me and realized that it didn't look good, so she came over and called 911, and then sat down and said she tried to talk to me while she waited for help. And then shortly thereafter, two other women, Sally and Kristen, were biking by, and they looked over and also realized that it didn't look good.
So Charity waves them over and explains the situation, that she just found Zach this way and that she's already called for help. And then Sally, who, remember, is an emergency room nurse, she looks him over.
He was on his side. I remember flipping him over and he was blue. Not moving, not breathing, not reacting. He was out. I thought he was already deceased.
Sally knew what a dead person looked like, and it looked a lot the way Zach looked. But she also knew that in this situation, you've got to at least try CPR. So she gets her friend Kristen, who'd been bike riding with her, into position.
So I quickly told her, I'm going to breathe, you're going to push on his chest, and we're going to count together.
And they start. They're doing CPR on Zach while this crowd is forming around them on the bike path. It takes a bit of time for the ambulance to arrive, or at least it seemed to.
I don't think it was that long. I think those things feel that way in the moment, and I kept thinking, where's help? Where's help?
They didn't quit. They kept going.
One and two and three and four and five.
I'm sure it was messy, it was ugly, and they just kept going.
Even if this is a lost cause, we can't stop. We can't stop. I know if we stop, he will definitely not survive. So that never crossed my mind, stopping, till we got relieved by rescue.
Eventually, the ambulance pulls up, and the EMS workers come running down the path.
They put on the AED, and it recognized the rhythm and shocked me. And it ultimately, I think, took three shocks to get my heart going again. And then from there, I was transported to a local hospital.
The ambulance pulls off, with Zach still unconscious in the back. And Sally is left standing there, trying to make sense of what just happened, what she saw.
He had a brand new shiny wedding band on, and that was really sad because I thought, oh my gosh, this young guy who is married to somebody. I thought they're going to take him to the hospital. They're probably going to pronounce him.
Zach, this otherwise healthy 36-year-old, his heart had stopped due to a condition that's really hard to predict. It wasn't a heart attack, which is caused by a blocked artery.
So I was in ventricular fibrillation, which is, you know, I'm not a medical person, but my layman's description is that it just means your heart basically gets out of electrical sync, and it is beating irregularly or in a way that is not allowing it to function properly.
For some reason, Zach's heart just started misfiring and stopped pumping blood. When the paramedic shocked him, the organ started beating again, but it wasn't clear how much damage had been done.
And I do remember that he was, like many cardiac arrest patients, completely unresponsive.
Benjamin Abella is the physician who treated Zach at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania.
Would not open his eyes, would not move.
While it was his heart that started all this, Abella and his team were worried the lack of blood flow had put Zach's brain in jeopardy. Abella says the hours after a cardiac arrest are really this race against the clock.
And that race against the clock is for irreversible brain injury. And so one of the ways we can affect that injury is to lower core body temperature. We call that therapeutic hypothermia.
Yeah, therapeutic hypothermia, intentionally cooling down the body. So the idea is a lower temperature slows everything down and limits inflammation that could cause complications.
It's not as easy as it sounds. There's technology involved and medications we have to give. But yes, we lower the core body temperature from normal 98.6 Fahrenheit to around 91 to 92 Fahrenheit, which doesn't sound like a lot. But as far as brain processes and body physiology, it's a huge temperature difference.
Zach's wife, Maura, remembers seeing this being done to Zach in his hospital bed.
He's completely asleep, eyes closed. He had a breathing tube, so he was having all the work done for him. He had several different IVs. And then he had sort of these like cool like water blankets that sort of were underneath his legs and arms and things like that as other ways to help control the temperature of his body.
Zach stayed like this, comatose, his body temperature held down around 91 degrees for 30 hours, kind of the maximum amount of time for therapeutic hypothermia. And those are some long hours when you don't even know if he's going to wake up.
Or, you know, if he was going to have full movements in his body, was he going to be able to, you know, write again? Was he going to be able to have a normal conversation? Was he able to, you know, work his job that he had before? Was he going to be able to work any job? All those sorts of questions that were sort of like constantly luring around. Is that, yes, I wanted him to be safe and I wanted to be alive, but what was his quality of life going to be?
Maura, as a doctor, knew that the outcomes in these situations are usually poor. Only about 10% of people who have cardiac arrest survive. CPR, like Sally and Kristen did to Zach, increases the chances to around 40%. But even then, many people experience long-term cognitive and memory problems. It turned into really just a waiting game to see what would happen to Zach.
The first day or two are really frightening. There's a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of instability, and Zach had some features of this. And we always counsel patients' families that watching a patient go through this, it's really a marathon, not a sprint. We won't have our answers within the first few hours or even within the first day.
When the time comes, Dr. Abella slowly begins to warm Zach's body back up. And then?
So I think at that moment that he actually opened his eyes, I had walked out of the room, of course, just like when everything good happens. And my parents were there, and so they came running to say, he moved. He's fluttering his eyes, and he moved.
Soon Zach is thrashing his arms and legs, pulling at all the cords, sort of in this delirious state.
And he looked at me, and I knew he knew it was me. But he didn't quite have the words yet to say very much. I knew he knew that like I was someone he loved and that he wanted me close, and he squeezed my hand. But it took, I think, several hours before like he could come up with all the words to sort of fill in those pieces.
By the next night, Zach was fully conscious, chatting.
He was like up, he was okay. We went to go get some food to eat and bring it back. And before I knew it, I like looked down at my phone and I looked at Facebook, and Zach had posted on Facebook. And he's like, hey everybody, I'm okay. Just wanted to let you know, thanks. And I'm like, oh my God, he's posting on Facebook. We have to go back. What is going on?
Zach spent another week in the hospital, during which time he had a device implanted in his body. It monitors his heart rhythm and can deliver a jolt if he goes into cardiac arrest again. And it's not really clear if he will. Doctors still aren't sure why it happened in the first place.
They don't know why. There's no obvious indicators. I don't have any structural abnormalities in my heart. There's no genetic things, markers they can find that indicate that this should have happened. It just did.
That randomness is honestly terrifying. But it's something Benjamin Abella sees over and over. So for him, it's more like a problem to solve. Or maybe the way to think about it is therapeutic hypothermia is a treatment, but it's also playing with time. It's like suspended animation, pausing the body to let it recover.
Many of us in resuscitation science throw around terms like he was dead, now he's not, and we talk in ways that seem bizarre, but it really is a strange and awkward thing, because in every sense of the word, Zach was dead. And now he's not. And that's amazing. We're realizing that, yes, death in the first minutes to hours may be a gray area. Historically, it was a very precise line. You were alive and then you were dead. Not as much so anymore. And we're pushing the boundary further and further. And it makes it very exciting. But it does make for some very strange conversations.
Zach
Zach continues to do well, and he and Maura are busy chasing after their twin toddlers. That was Todd Bookman reporting. And I loved what the cardiologist said at the end about this gray area, the line between being dead and alive, and how it's becoming more blurred these days. And he also said modern medicine keeps pushing that boundary. For example, think about this. Having a pulse is usually considered one of the hallmarks of being alive. Yet Linda Jarrah went about her business and lived her life without having a pulse for months. Her ordeal began with what felt like a sinus infection that just wouldn't go away. She was 43 years old at the time, and she'd been healthy so far. But then she felt awful, and after many doctor's visits and tests, she found out her heart was failing.
They knew that they had to go to the next step, that I was not getting any better. So March 3rd, my mother's birthday, I had the LVAD put in. And what this device does is I have a pump that's right up, I guess, right above my rib cage. And it has two like hoses that go in, and it's used to bypass the aorta. And it's a continuous flow that will keep my heart pumping. So I can't have a heart attack if that was to happen. I don't have a pulse. I can tell you where you can microphone it. That's me. That's what I sound like on the inside. I could not come home because I live by myself. So I spent 3 months at my sister's house, sleeping in my niece's room. And she has like Taylor Swift posters up and everything's pink and princesses. And so she's 8 now and my nephew's 7. And there's always a story I tell. It was right before Easter and I had gone outside and I put some stuff in the mailbox and I walked up and down my sister's driveway and I did it for 7 minutes. And I was so excited and I came in and Brendan, my nephew, was the first person I saw. And I was like, Brendan, guess what? And he's like, what? He's excited for me. And I said, I just walked for 7 minutes straight. And his smile like turned into like disgust. And he was like, are you kidding me? That is like kindergarten easy. And you're excited about that? And I was just laughing because I wasn't laughing then. I kind of shuffled back to the bedroom and like put my head down. I was like, oh, I guess it was kindergarten easy. And I tell that story because I now do the elliptical. And the longest time I've spent on the elliptical is 7 miles. So I do the elliptical every day between 3 and 5 miles a day. And I'm really trying to get active. I went back to work full time. I teach 11th grade at Valley Forge Military Academy. I went to one of the support groups at Temple. And there were 4 of us there. It was myself, 76-year-old man, 78-year-old woman, and an 84-year-old woman. There are people on VADS who are so unhappy that they have this device. And I can't go in water. I can get electrocuted. And they just go on and they'll just complain about how they can't go swimming and they can't. But I'm like, but you're alive. And it was looking pretty bad for me. You know, I was glad to be alive. And there have been people who are considering VADS or people who just ask me, they're like, what made you decide to get this? And I was like, I didn't have a choice. You know, at that time, my niece was 7. She's the oldest. And I just said, you know what? I want to go to her wedding. I want to dance at her wedding. And I don't, you know, I want to be around for that. There are 200,000 people that need hearts a year and about 2,000 become available. Hearts are good on average for about 10 years. Lungs are good for about 5 to 7 years. And I said, well, what does that mean? What do you mean, like 10 years? They're like, well, in 10 years, then you just get listed again for, and I'm like, I have to go through this again? And I was like, wait a minute. I don't even know if I want to do this now. And I was like, what are my chances? I did say, what are my odds if I just leave the hospital? I don't think my odds were very good. I don't think I had odds, to be honest with you. People would say, oh, I could never do what you did, and I could never go through this. And I would say, you would, because when you're faced with these decisions, like you have to do it.
Paige Flager produced this piece a year ago, and we have an update on Linda Jara. So she was living with this LVAD heart assist machine in her chest. She was even able to go back to work as a high school teacher, but she was waiting for a heart transplant. And then she got the phone call she had been waiting for. She told us how that happened during our recent Story Slam.
My wait ended on September 21st, 2016. And at 3 o'clock, I got the phone call. My last class had just finished. I got the phone call, and it was my transplant coordinator, Peggy. And when that happens, when you get those calls, I had two prior, your heart stops. My heart could not stop because it was going to keep going no matter what. And I had, she said, we have a match. I need you to get to Temple as soon as possible. And at that time, all of your emotions crashed together. You're happy, you're sad, you're worried, and you're excited. And I got to spend those few moments with 11th grade boys. Very empathetic, very empathetic.
Linda was in surgery for 10 hours. She spent 23 days in the hospital. Then she returned home to begin her life again. She had a rejection scare early on, but now she's doing well.
I've started cardio rehab. I do a great 1.2 miles per hour. So, but I'm getting there. I am getting there. I got some blue and green put in my hair for organ donation colors, so that was something fun I could do since I lived for 18 months, like, in a cocoon. And that's where we are. That's where I am, and every day gets better, so, wow. So thank you.
That was Linda Jara speaking at a Pulse Story Slam. And since we've been talking about cardiology, I wanted to mention that the music we're hearing comes from the Baby Blue Sound Collective. This is an ensemble of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, and other medical professionals from children's hospitals around the world. All of them care for children and young adults who have heart disease, and this album is called Home Tonight Forever. Coming up, a woman grieving her husband finds a new life mission and a new community.
They started sharing what happened to them and their mom and their dad, and some of them were horrific stories. But it was good to talk to people who were as equally broken as I was.
That's next on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about love, passion, and heart on today's show, but not in the chocolate, roses, and champagne kind of way. We're looking at how people's love for others and their passion fuels what they do. That notion reminded me of Regina Holiday. We met her on The Pulse last year. She's an artist and a patient's rights activist. She speaks at a lot of conferences.
We can do better, whatever our role is.
These days, she has the ear of lawmakers and high-powered healthcare executives, but a few years ago, she was a frightened wife trying to get the best care for her husband, who had kidney cancer. At one point during his treatment, Regina says they needed access to his healthcare records, and the hospital wanted to charge her 73 cents per page. She was outraged.
It's sort of like a slap in the face. Like, really, really, after all that you've done, after the $60,000 it just cost to be in this hospital, you're going to charge me 73 cents per page just to see the information that we've already paid for. We've paid for all these services. There's no other industry that charges you for the receipt.
She was mad as hell about not having access to those records, and that anger stayed with her even after Fred died in 2009 when she was exhausted and grieving. So eventually, she channeled her rage into art. She painted a mural at a busy Washington, D.C. intersection. It depicts Fred on a hospital bed and Regina trying to navigate a cold and confusing maze of healthcare.
I've got a plastic Halloween mask on facing my husband, and that plastic Halloween mask is a pretty girl. Because what I'm trying to be is this pretty, loving wife while my husband's going through all this, and you can't see my face beneath that, the struggling face, right?
The mural created a bit of a stir. Regina soon started to speak up about patients' rights, access to medical records. She gained a following online, and soon things took off from there. Pulse reporter Alana Gordon brought us her story.
Soon, Regina was being invited to press conferences with lawmakers. She attended public meetings on the Hill, asking questions about the needs of patients in designing health technology policies. She gained a following. Social media helped. And about 2 years in, her mural art changed course. I guess you could say it caught some new legs. Literally.
Somebody reached out to me on Twitter, and they wanted to wear a patient's story in a medical conference where patients were not invited. And so I painted the story of Fred and I on her back. And so she wore it, and she talked about it.
From there, Holiday started painting stories of other people's healthcare experiences on their suit jackets. It turned into a collection of mini murals on people's backs, traveling to spaces where the patient's story has often been left out, where conversations about medical records often focus on how to make it work for the providers, the billers, the systems of care. Regina called it the walking gallery of healthcare. The idea was to remind everyone, hospital execs, policymakers, that we're all patients.
So these paintings are on the back of people. So when they go to health conferences, a gallery starts to form because there's these paintings literally walking down the hallway and you're walking amongst them. And the person who's wearing it becomes a docent of their life.
Holiday has over 400 jackets now. She doesn't sell them. Other artists are involved. And she has everyone from a homeless man in Baltimore to a lead doctor at a Kaiser Permanente think tank to the head of the White House Office of Health Information Technology wearing them.
I saw Regina's art for the first time, and I remember grabbing her hands and saying, "Thank you for giving me permission to be angry about what happened."
This is Whitney Zatskin. She was working in government affairs when she joined the gallery. It was after her stepmom died of bladder cancer, after early warning signs were missed. Now she's leading a project aimed at improving care. I met up with her and a few other people who are part of the gallery in D.C.
If you live in the policy world or the business world, and I live in several different worlds, often conversations are very based on ideas and economics and all these other abstract ideas, and they forget the real, true, everyday truths of being a person. I'm Ligia Ricciardi, and I work in the area of digital health and consumer engagement. I've also spent a lot of time in the federal government. This is a picture of me and my two daughters, and this was a story about me wanting to have a very natural
My jacket is my about baby. The not-so-good decision-making that went on when I was trying to decide if my daughter should start taking a step.
My name is Marilyn Mann. I volunteer with the American Heart Association.
I'm Anita Samarth. I'm the CEO of Clinovations Government and Health. Personally, this is less so about my health story, but the role that I play in ensuring that we think about patients in the center. I don't know, is this me on the back? And I guess, yes, I personally.
I love going to a new conference and going my first day without my jacket and then observing and then going my second day with my jacket and just quietly monitoring how the conversations change.
It's great because it gets people asking questions.
There's different types of people that'll run up to me and grab me and say, "Oh my gosh, I love the walking gallery." And there's a whole other world of people who were my best friends the day before that now are very like, "Oh, you're the weird punk rock chick in the corner. What are we doing?"
Holiday and others say at first people seemed frightened, thinking they were angry patients. But she felt they were confusing anger with passion.
So to put a walking gallery jacket on the back of a business suit, which is an emblem of power, is really amazing. Because you take that really important space and you put a patient's story smack dab in the middle of it. And now you've reclaimed your power.
Now, the jackets have become more embraced in the digital health sphere. They're almost expected conversation starters, serving as a reminder of why people do what they do and what's at stake.
Conferences often grant walking gallery members special access to events that would otherwise be really pricey. And in the world of healthcare and technology, that's a big deal. These are often the spaces where policies take shape, where leaders in the public and private sphere get their ideas. And Holliday says over the past 7 years, the whole field has been shifting in a major way. It's been 7 years now since Regina's husband, Fred, died, since she painted this mural depicting their roller coaster of care off this main DC street. Regina doesn't get back to this mural much. She lives about 3 hours away now. The mural has weathered some over time. And when we stop by, she notices a few areas where bricks and paint have chipped off. So she darts away and returns with some paint from a nearby store.
So right now I'm taking paint and I'm squeezing it out in my palette because when you have an outside mural, one of the things you gotta do periodically is fix it.
She wants to repaint those parts that have come off to preserve Fred's story.
And I need a whole bunch of colors because I've got a match tone to the colors that are there right now.
Green and pink and orange
whole
and yellow.
Palette. Yeah, it's everything.
Regina hoists herself up on the thin brick wall, about 4 feet high, almost as tall as her. She leans against the mural for balance. She then reaches up to an exposed spot in the gray-blue sheet that's wrapped around Fred, lying there, eyes closed, on that hospital bed. Just above her arm and paintbrush, Fred's own arm rests on that sheet. He's holding a piece of paper. On it is a message he wrote. It says, "Go get 'em, Regina."
I miss Fred. I miss Fred every single day. I mean, he was my soulmate, so it's sad. But on the other side of that, I've been put in a position in my life to try to make the world better, to help other people. And that's a blessing.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we've been talking about the love and passion people feel for what they do. Regina found that passion during a very dark time in her life, and our last story on today's show hits on a similar theme. Michael Bohannon Calloway told this story during our recent Pulse Story Slam.
My name is Michael Bohannon Calloway, and most of my life, I thought I was a failure. January 2010, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, cancer of the plasma cells in the bone marrow, treatable but incurable. So I started my chemotherapy regimen, went to cancer support groups, and it was there that I decided to share some of my fears about dying, about life, about being a gay male almost 50 years old and not having any legacy. I found strength in that cancer support group, and they convinced me to work and chip away at my bucket list. And one of those items was getting a PhD. Fast forward to the third week of September 2014. It's amazing how your life can change in just an instant. And mine did in less than 72 hours. First, the university contacted me and said that because I didn't have enough participants in my dissertation study, that a year's worth of research and writing had to be scrapped and I had to start over. Two, I was in an abusive, emotionally and physical relationship that I was trying to end. Third, at my oncology appointment, the doctor said, with all of the stress, your cancer has come back. You're no longer in remission. So what does one do? Except cut a big piece of German chocolate cake. And swallow 150 pills. When I didn't show up for work the next day, two coworkers sent first responders to my house. When the EMTs broke down my door, They found me almost lifeless. I'm told less than 20 minutes from being successful. Well, at that particular moment, while they were taking vitals and such, I projectiled vomit. They were freaking out. They thought that my esophagus had collapsed, evaporated, my stomach lining had hemorrhaged, and all I could do was say, "It's cake. It's cake." When you spend a lot of time in the hospital like I did, you start thinking about life, even how it's spelled. L-I-F-E. There's a big if in the middle. And a lot of people say, if only I had more time, if only this or only that. Having cancer and suffering from depression, I learned how to reframe that if into a question of what if? What if I set how successful I am rather than trying to live to someone else's expectations? What if I am in charge of my own happiness? What if, with every sense of my being, look at things from a different perspective, with compassion, happiness, empathy? Well, today, I'm not a failure. I'm happy, I'm healthy, and my name is Michael Bohannon Calloway, Ph.D.
Michael told this story during a recent story slam we hosted together with the Annals of Internal Medicine. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Tanya English is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. So we celebrated the heart this week. Next week, the pulse goes straight to your head.
The more technology we get and the better we can study the brain, the more we realize, you know, just how beautiful it is, you know, and how incredibly complex it is.
How do our brains function and what happens when things go awry? We'll take a look at a treatment for a severe depression that psychiatrists wish more people would consider.
The amazing thing is we've got electrical currents in our brains right now. As we're talking to each other, as you're listening to me, that's how the brain works.
But patients tend to be appalled.
And I just sort of said, no way, I'm not getting my brain shocked.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a review that allows other people to find The Pulse as well.
Penn Medicine's Transplant Institute supports WHYY. With over 50 years of transplant experience and over 10,000 successful transplanted patients, Penn offers patients advanced options to help decrease wait times and improve outcomes. Learn more about all the options to help patients live and thrive at pennmedicine.org/penntransplant or 800-789-PENN. Because your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.